Welcome to Making Sense, supported by KiwiBank. I'm Frances Cook, an independent financial journalist of many years, best-selling author, and financial freedom seeker who helps make money simple for you. Now, there's investing, and then there's capital I investing, the one that comes with big risk, and if it works, big reward. Today's guest is someone who's flown under the radar in that scene for quite a while, first working at some of our iconic tech startups and then investing into them. Rowan Simpson started out by saving up $10,000 to create his own tech company, flathunt.co.nz, and he's since gone on a journey that involves TradeMe, Xero, Vend, Timely. These are iconic New Zealand tech companies, and he's got millions more than that first $10,000. Now, he's a private and early stage venture investor, keeping an eye out for that next great business that can take the world by storm. So how did he get from $10,000 to tens of millions? And what does he want the rest of us to know before we try to copy him?
Before we get into it, Making Sense is stoked to be supported by KiwiBank. We've teamed up to bring you insight directly from their people, the experts who live and breathe this stuff every day. It's not the outdated stuff that worked 5 years ago. It's what's happening right now in the industry to help you make the most of your money. This is making Kiwi better off. This is Kiwi.
I'm joined now by Rowan Simpson, author of the brand new book, How to Be Wrong, A Crash Course in Startup Success, which is a fantastic title. I love it. And I was just saying to you off camera that I'm just going to introduce you as an author, because if I list your entire CV, we'll be here for 5 minutes before we get into the actual interview. I mean, you've been a founding team member and investor at some of New Zealand's big success stories. And we're mostly talking like tech success stories. So we're talking Xero, TradeMe, Vend, Timely, big companies, iconic for anyone who pays attention to that scene. So what got you interested in this startup world, and what makes you such a sucker for punishment to keep coming back for more?
Yeah, I mean, I'm pleased you introduced it that way. I always struggle to describe what I've done. So yeah, I mean, I would love to be able to tell you there's a nice succinct answer to that question, and that there was kind of this eureka moment where you know, it all became obvious what I should do. But actually, it was much more convoluted than that, and it would probably take all of this time that we have to tell the honest story. I did my own startup before TradeMe. It was called Flat Hunt. It was a classified site for people wanting to rent a house or a room. That eventually became part of TradeMe Property once I was working at TradeMe and involved in that in the early days. But yeah, that was my startup. And I came to it much more through curiosity than through wanting to do a business and be, you know, be a successful entrepreneur. I was a software engineer actually originally, and that was kind of my route into it. I was kind of just experimenting with the tools. It was the very early day of the web in the early 2000s. And I was just kind of tinkering and trying to work out what was possible and following my nose. And it was a very convoluted path into it. But, you know, it's easy now to look back and try and retrospectively invent a great story about how it happened.
And it's funny, isn't it? Because now we look at a lot of these digital first companies and they're seen as absolute gold mines. And a lot of them are gold mines. Was there an idea of what they could be at that time when the world wasn't as online as it is now?
No. So, I mean, like I was determined to start this book that I've written with the opposite stories, actually. So like the first chapter is the near-death moments of all four of those companies that you just listed off. And, you know, like we know them now as successful companies because of the outcomes that were achieved. But, you know, when I was working on them, it was far less certain that they were going to survive, let alone be successful businesses. And so those are the stories that often get sort of airbrushed out of the histories of these companies when we tell the stories. And so I think it's kind of interesting. And for me, those are the most interesting parts of all of those stories, not the glorious moments in the spotlight, but like, you know, the hard grind, the days that things sometimes felt like it was going to fall flat on our face. And so, yeah, it's kind of, you know, telling those stories is kind of the delight of this book in some ways.
What's the biggest one that stands out for you in terms of those near-death moments? And is there anything that still keeps you awake at night now if you get like a flashback?
I mean, they all had happy endings. So it's kind of, I guess, you know, these stories are in some ways easier to tell as a result of that. But yeah, let me tell you the story of Trade Me's near-death moment. In early 2001, the company was about 2 years old. There were four of us working at in the team at that stage. So Sam Morgan, who was the founder, his sister Jessie, myself, and my old friend Nigel Stanford, who was actually the person who drew the blue kiwi, which is the Trade Me logo. And the company had run out of money. Like, Sam had raised a small amount of capital. We'd spent all of that. The business model wasn't really working. At that stage, the site was completely free to use, and we were trying to sell advertising to fund it, and it just didn't work. And at that point, shareholders were effectively propping the company up. I was a shareholder because they'd acquired Flat Hunt from me, but I didn't have any money to lend. And so I was sort of working each month for lower and lower salary payments, and that became untenable. And I left. I went to the UK for my OE. And at the same time, Sam and Jess also left. So at one point, all three of us were living and working in London. Nigel was kind of holding it all together with String and Blue Tack back in New Zealand. And yeah, like the thing that ultimately, I guess, changed the trajectory for that, shortly before we all left, we turned on success fees. So we copied eBay's business model of charging sellers a small amount when they successfully sold something. And ultimately that turned into a very lucrative business model. You know, it was only like 5-6 years after that we sold the business for $750 million. It's kind of remarkable to think, you know, how close we were to not surviving at all at that point. At that point then. And yeah, like as I say before, like those parts of the stories are very often just airbrushed or skipped over entirely. And so people working on their own startups often don't understand that that was the reality for those companies, even those ones that were great successes in the end.
Yeah, yeah. I want to come back to that because I do think looking back with the rosy glasses is a chronic one, actually, and you can forget how hard people had to grind on that. Mm-hmm. But when you're first looking at some of these companies that you've been involved with in various capacities, you are now someone who is an investor and you foster interesting ideas. You've worked in some of these companies, you now invest in companies like this. What draws you to a particular idea and makes you think, actually, that could work?
Yeah. I try not to get too distracted by the idea, to be honest. It's really easy to be drawn in by the invention, you know, the novel thing or the thing that can be built. But the thing that all of those successful companies have in common is they really started with a customer pain. You know, they started with the problem to be solved, if you like, and worked backwards from there to the technology. So yeah, the technology, the idea is often not the most interesting or defining part of these companies. It's much more often, you know, how you've been able to use that technology or that idea to actually solve a real problem for real people in a valuable way. So that's the bit that I tend to focus on now when I'm looking at companies. There's a common expression in startups, which is product market fit. So you talk about whether the idea has kind of found an audience. I'm kind of in some ways more interested in founder market fit. Like, you know, what's the unique thing that the person who's working on this business has seen about those, you know, those potential customers that gives them a unique insight?
Okay. What makes that different? Because I think a lot of people do focus on that idea. So what makes that approach from you different? And obviously at this point in your career, quite successful.
Yeah, I mean, it's much more about the people. Like, you know, if I look at the investments that I've made post Trade Me and Xero, the ones that have been most successful are investments into specific people who had a real, you know, a good insight about a particular market problem that they were trying to solve, and were the right people at the right time to solve that problem. And so, you know, that's a little bit like catching lightning in a bottle. But if you kind of, if you sort of step back, you can see that pattern, and it is repeatable.
I've heard it described before because I've talked to a few people in various positions throughout the business community. I mean, people who've had successful businesses that maybe didn't turn out to be monsters, but, you know, were successful. And then people who've had ideas, maybe it did, didn't pan out. Something that's come up again and again from people I've talked to is you can get too hung up on that idea point. And you can also sometimes tell who's new in the startup scene because they might be wanting to hand out NDAs before they talk to you about anything. And a conversation that really stuck with me one time is when someone said, I actually, you know, the idea, anyone can have an idea, and most people do.
It's whether or not you're going to be able to turn that into a reality for the years that it will take of finding solutions, finding customers, and building something. That is, you can have the best idea in the world, but if you can't get through that grind, you're going to be beaten by someone with a mediocre idea. And is that sort of what you're getting at there?
Exactly. I mean, ideas are kind of, to have a great idea, you need to have, you know, one unique insight. Like, to execute a great idea, you need to do thousands of little things over and over again, repeatedly over a long period of time. And so they're quite different things, you know, like I would almost make the distinction between inventors and founders in that sense. So inventors are the people who have that kind of, you know, eureka moment where they see the future. And that's great. And that's, you know, it's useful, don't get me wrong. But the people who create great businesses are the people who are able to execute ideas. And execution is much more about that sort of hard grind and iteration and constant improvement than it is about, you know, the amazing discovery. And you mentioned NDAs. It's one of the great negative tells. If somebody is in any way protective of their idea, as an investor, that's an immediate turn off. Like, you know, I'm interested in people who are desperately seeking all the feedback they can get, because that's what, you know, that constant iteration on the idea, the constant kind of refinement based on other people's perspectives, based on little experiments, is what ultimately, you know, crafts ideas into great businesses.
The startup world does seem really hard. You obviously coming in as an investor, I mean, I'm sure it's quite different as an investor than someone who is working in the team and scrapping it out there. But you were there for some of these companies scrapping it out in the very, very early days. Weren't you the first non-Morgan who was employed at Trade Me, the first one outside the family?
Yeah, I mean, it was just Sam to start with, and he raised some money and hired his sister. And then, I was the first one after that. So I guess I was the first one who didn't share the surname, but.
So entirely on the ground floor there. Yeah. And it must have all felt incredibly precarious. And was there a time when you were there and you thought, actually, this is too precarious? I don't know if we're actually going to win here.
Yeah, I mean, to the extent that I left, I guess, you know, that's almost like the most extreme version of answering that question. I think when I left to go to London, I wasn't certain that there would be a Trade Me to come back to at that point. And, you know, like that's in some ways a repeated pattern too. Like, you know, I left Xero in 2008, so about 18 months or so after the IPO. The share price was under a dollar, I think, at that point. It was lower than the listing price. It wasn't obvious that the company would survive and be a great success. And, you know, I mean, I tell the story in the book of all of the other companies which have similar experiences. Like, these are repeated patterns. Like, these companies are not smooth overnight success stories. They often have a lot of rocky points along the way. And I think that's the important thing for people who are working on their own thing to understand is that all the way through they feel precarious and it's not obvious that they'll survive, let alone thrive.
Mm. So when you were going through some of these companies, and you've been involved, as I've said, quite a few iconic companies, was there ever a time when you thought maybe we might burn out here?
I don't know if I'd say burn out. I mean, like, managing your own energy levels in these companies is an important thing. And they do come what I call unbounded commitments. Mm. You know, I think one of the things you hear people talk a lot about in business is kind of that work-life balance. Like, startups are sort of inherently unbalanced things. And so, you know, they need to be a conscious choice. Like, they're not things that you work on by accident, I don't think, or at least if you do, they're unlikely to be successful. They're things that you kind of commit to and really focus on, and are intense because of that. And, you know, like, that intensity ultimately is what makes them rewarding when they work, I suppose. So that's the quid pro quo.
It's funny, isn't it? The idea of work-life balance. I kind of look at that as being something that you might have over the course of a lifetime. And I'd love to know your perspective on that, because I think there are times in life where you might have to front load the effort and put in a lot ahead in order to enjoy something later on, or you might have sprint modes. No, you cannot run a marathon at a sprint level, but there might be times when genuinely you need to go sprint mode and you should just put the blinkers on and go for it. And is that what you're interested in when you're looking at some of these companies?
Yeah, I mean, I think balance is misunderstood. I think I would sort of reframe that as consciously choosing what you want to prioritize and focus on. Like, the idea that you can do everything is something that I think a lot of us have been missold.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you do have to trade off. You do have to trade off family. You do have to trade off hobbies. You do have to trade off sleep. You do have to trade off fitness. And like, you can probably only choose maybe two or three of those things at most if you want to really commit to a startup. But yeah, it's just, I mean, my advice to the folks who are doing the hard jobs now, like being an investor compared to being a founder is relatively easy in that sense. But just consciously choosing which of those things you're going to prioritize and deprioritize so that you make sure you have the priorities in the right order. I think that's the key for me. And there's no right answer. Like, you know, for some people, really prioritizing the business that they're working on and giving that their full effort, that's the right answer for them for a period of time in their life. It certainly was true for me. You know, for that to become an unbounded commitment is really what gives it a chance of being successful. Make those choices consciously, I guess, is the advice that I give.
What periods of your life would you categorize as being those consciously chosen sprint efforts? And how long did you go for? Would you ever do it again?
I mean, I was only 30 when we sold TradeMe in 2006. So, you know, I was relatively young when I was in those kind of operator roles in these businesses. And yeah, I mean, I guess if I reflect on my own answers to those questions, our youngest child was born about 18 months before we sold TradeMe. And so, you know, it was very grounding for me to have to go home at lunchtime and in the evenings and be a parent, be a dad. And so I guess those were the things that I kind of prioritized at that point in life. And then other things came later, you know, like you don't have to commit to these choices permanently and forever because, as you say, it often is a sprint. Like, these companies aren't overnight successes, but, you know, if you can commit to it for a period of years, and then, you know, that opens up all sorts of possibilities if you do. So,
when you look back at your time there, is there anything that you think, actually, I got that wrong? And if I had my time over, I'd do it again. And this could be at any of them, you know. Now, let's widen it out. The Xero, TradeMe, Venn, Timely are sort of the big ones. Mm. There's others. Mm. But is there anything you think that I got that wrong and actually I'd do it again differently?
Yeah, I mean, I have told the story in the book of a few of those companies that I don't talk about quite so frequently or loudly that didn't go so well. But I mean, you know, the book is called How to Be Wrong. Like, there's a bit of a hint to that. Like, the experience of working on these companies is to be constantly confronted with the ways that you're wrong. And if you like, we can run through the three ways that there are to be wrong.
Do it. Hit me with them.
Yeah, cool. Okay, so there's only three ways. The first way to be wrong is to not even ask the question. So, like, not to measure, not to inquire about whether what you're working on is working or not.
Mm.
The second way to be wrong is to make a mistake. Like, we all have biases, especially in the early days of companies. You're often dealing with a very small, you know, early adopter set of customers, which don't always extrapolate. But you just have to have your eyes open to the possibility that there's, you know, that the thing you are measuring isn't giving you accurate information. And then the last and third and last way to be wrong is just to lie, like to know that something's not working, but to kind of pretend to everybody else that it is.
Mm.
I mean, that might sound facetious, but it's actually surprisingly common in startups, as you read about. And so, like, there's easy things you can do to avoid all three of those ways to be wrong. And if you do that, you give yourself a chance to be right.
Mm.
And so, yeah, one of the pieces of advice that you often hear naive people give founders working on startups is kind of like, fail fast. Like, you know, this idea of failure is kind of glamorized in the startup world. And actually, my experience of working on these companies sort of taught me the opposite. Like, failure really sucks. Like, I've experienced it a few times and it's really painful when a business fails. So what you want instead of that is like hundreds of tiny failures, like constantly, every day, little mistakes and short feedback loops. So you can learn from those mistakes and improve on them the next time, the next day or the next week, and sort of build on that foundation. And, you know, if you do that repeatedly, that's the hard grind I was talking about before, like doing that over and over, over a period of years, and really focusing on the results you're getting and the things you're learning from those results. Like, that's what lets you build towards success.
It's really coming back to people a lot, isn't it? Which is an interesting part. I think often people can get really hung up on the numbers, and as we've already talked about, some of the ideas that go into a business.
Mm.
And what you've pulled out there in the ways to be wrong, they're all very human foibles.
Mm.
And I would even drill it down further It sounds like ego would be involved in a lot of them. Do you think ego is a business killer?
Yeah, I mean, I do. I don't really subscribe to that idea of the, you know, the hero founder and the fake it till you make it kind of mindset that often is promoted to founders. I think the opposite. I think in many cases, that's really dangerous advice. And yeah, you're absolutely right. Like you, it's much better. You give yourself a much better chance of success, I should say, if you can kind of put ego to the side and be open to the possibility that you're wrong, like that what you're doing might not work, because that really then tunes your attention on what you need to prove to yourself and to others to know that it is working, and, you know, really paying attention to the numbers and seeing what they're showing you, but really also paying attention to other people's feedback and perspective on what you're working on and listening to that and changing course when you need to. Like that's what gets you there. So this idea that you have to kind of be right from the beginning, like be all knowing and be all confident, I'm not sure that always leads to great outcomes. Whereas I guess I've proven that the other way is kind of more methodical way of getting there.
Speaking of numbers though, because I know people are going to want to know this. I mean, being involved from the very ground level with some of these companies, did you get stock options? Because that must have been good for the wallet.
Not options in any of them, actually. So I was a Trade Me shareholder as a result of them acquiring Flathunt from me. So I sold my startup into Trade Me and became a shareholder that way. And that was obviously a fantastic financial result. I was an investor in all of the others. So I invested in Xero. I invested pre-IPO and then again in the IPO in Xero. And then Vend and Timely, I was the first investor or one of the first investors in both of those companies in the first round. So, you know, I invested real capital in those businesses, you know, relatively modest amounts compared to what we got out, but, you know, right at the beginning when there was not much to show for it. And yeah, if you're willing to make those kinds of investments, they can be extremely lucrative. Like, you know, all four of those were tens of millions of dollars, each of them, for me in terms of outcomes, which is amazing and life-changing. But, you know, putting aside the actual numbers, I think the most interesting part of that actually is the cumulative story of it. Like the only reason I was able to invest in Xero is because of the success we had at Trade Me. The only reason I was able to invest in Vend and Timely and all of the other things that I've invested in since then is because of the success of Xero financially. So, you know, the cumulative compounding effect of that is ultimately, I think, the most interesting part of that story. And that could apply to anyone, whether you're talking about millions of dollars or hundreds of dollars or thousands of dollars. Like that compounding effect is the amazing part.
People are going to ask this, so I'm going to ask it on their behalf. Did you start out with anything, or was it pure sweat equity in the beginning?
So I invested, I think, about $10,000 of my savings in getting Flathunt off the ground. So that was like the hard cash investment. Mm-hmm. My girlfriend at the time, who's now still my wife all these years later, effectively supported me through the first part of that business. So, you know, she had a day job and was covering our rent and expenses. Flathunt never really made that much money. So, but that was why I got it to a point where it was breaking even broadly, but that was why I started doing some contracting work. And one of those contracts was with Sam and Phil and the crew at Trade Me. So sometimes not having money actually does lead you to interesting places as well, if you're sort of forced to think about how you approach it.
To go from $10,000 invested though, and then of course, you know, I'm sure you could probably trace through of like how much you put in of working without making anything for a while there.
Right, yeah.
But to go from that to tens of millions, as you say, it's funny because it's something we talk about a lot, both here and on my social media channels, of the first few steps with your money are the hardest.
Mm.
When you're building from nothing, it feels like you're going nowhere. And yet, you know, that 0 to 100,000 leap, hard. 100,000 to a million, surprisingly often far less hard. And then a million to whatever else, you know, you can suddenly start building more opportunities. It is interesting, as you say, the compounding effect, right? Mm. Of if you can get one win and then build on that and then build more wins on that.
Mm.
It's not that at any point it gets easy, I wouldn't say. I don't want to undermine the work that goes into it.
Mm.
But as you build up these wins, they work together to be far more powerful together than they are on their own, don't they?
Yeah, that's definitely true. And I would say that's true for the pure financial aspect of it, but it's true probably more importantly for all of the other aspects of it. Like, you know, the things you learn when you work on a startup change you. Like they change the way you see the world, and they change the way that you'll make decisions in the future. They'll change the things that you choose to work on in the future, in my experience. And so, you know, those experiences are also invaluable and compound. And same with the relationships. Like, you know, many of the most successful investments I've made since I've been an investor into these sorts of companies are people that I knew through those connections of having worked in those previous successful companies. And, you know, you see people spinning out of Trade Me and Xero and Vend and other companies that have been successful and doing their own startups. And it's that kind of, again, that kind of cumulative compounding effect of that is how an ecosystem of companies grows, how an economy of companies ultimately grows. And you know, so it's true for the financial piece, but it's true for all aspects of those companies, I think.
And now you're taking that perspective, and as we've touched on a little bit, you do private investments and early stage venture investments. First of all, let's figure out what that is, because a lot of the people who listen to this podcast are familiar with, you know, the share market and buying into businesses in that way. What is different about your private investments, early stage venture investments?
Yeah, so I mean, we invest now through our family office, which is an expression you don't hear a lot in New Zealand. Overseas, I guess where there's more wealth, that's a kind of more common expression, but it's effectively a private fund. We're just investing our own money. So we, you know, we also invest in the stock market, like your listeners, but you know, I guess an outsized portion of that portfolio of investments that we do are private companies. Mm. So either through venture funds or directly into companies, you know, where we have that connection with the founders and are able to invest early in those companies as, you know, often initial shareholders. And so, yeah, that's a very different sort of mode of investment. It's a very illiquid mode of investment. You know, you have to be very patient capital when you invest in those sorts of companies. Sometimes it can take 7, 8, 9, 10 years before you'll see anything material, you know, out of those companies. And you also have to be prepared for the risk or the uncertainty, more importantly, that's involved in those investments. So they're, you know, they're quite different from investments into the stock market, but they can be very lucrative if you can select the right companies to invest in through those. Mm. And yeah, I think one of the things we've seen in New Zealand over the last maybe 4 or 5 years especially is the emergence of a really good layer of venture funds. So there are now multiple good funds. Many of your listeners might be investors in a small way into some of those funds that themselves invest in young companies, you know, either at the very early stage, which is sometimes called the seed stage, or maybe later when those companies need some more capital to grow. And so, yeah, you can be an investor in those funds and get some exposure to those, you know, those companies at the early part of their growth.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I think the stock market, by the time people are investing in something there, I mean, by the time something lists on the stock market, it's usually a certain size. The idea is proven to a certain extent. They're looking for investment to take them to the next level in some way. And yet, when you're getting in to meet these companies, it might be, you know, a couple of employees. It might be very much still figuring it out.
Even calling them a company sometimes is a bit misleading. Often it's just a founder and maybe one or two others. So yeah, they're embryonic, you know, if you see them right at the beginning. And often they haven't really found their form yet. Often they sometimes even haven't found the final product yet. But if you have conviction about the people, back to that, then, you know, and back them to kind of iterate towards an idea that might work, then those can be lucrative investments.
Life is full of ups and downs, so no matter what your everyday looks like, KiwiBank has the products and services to help you manage your money your way. To find out more, head to kiwibank.co.nz. This is making Kiwi better off. This is KiwiBank.
How much do you get involved? Like, what's, and I think everyone will have a different line on this, so it's obviously this is going to be quite personal to you, but how much of it is an exchange of money to help them build what they're working on? Mm. And how much do you get involved in the actual business itself as well? Like, do you give these companies advice?
Yeah. I mean, sometimes I like to describe it as effectively paying for a job because, you know, if I invest, say, a couple of $100,000 in the very early stages of a business, which is, you know, effectively what I did at Vend and Timely, that's great, but I'm paying for a job for the next 5 years or more in those companies. So they can be a lot of work if you're a really engaged investor. One of the things I like to say is that the best founders choose their investors. And I think one of the things that the best founders will look for are investors who can actually contribute more than just capital to those early stages. So if you're able to, you know, roll your sleeves up and get involved with actually helping turn the company into a success, you're actually doing that execution we were talking about earlier, then that's much more valuable to founders than just money.
Do you ever find resistance on that though? Because I mean, take this as someone who I create a lot of content for a living. I've written a lot of stuff in various places. And so often people will say, oh, I've written something. Can you give me feedback on it? And I choose very carefully who I say yes to, because my experience, a lot of people say they want feedback, and when they get feedback, they don't love it. So do you ever have resistance from founders?
Yeah, giving advice in the early stages of a company is a delicate art. That's certainly true. Yeah, I mean, I guess I don't so much, because that's one of the criteria that I'm very conscious of when I'm looking at a company and whether I want to invest in it is what I call the coachability of the founders, like whether they're actually open to feedback, and more importantly, whether they are willing to experiment with the ideas that someone shares with them. Because any advice is just perspective. Like, it, you know, a lot of the advice that I will give to founders is useful, but some of it's probably wrong. And I also have my own biases and scar tissue. So, you know, the behavior that you're looking for is someone who's kind of really willing to listen to that and then think about, well, how would we experiment with that and see if it applies in our situation? And yeah, if you can find people who have that mindset, they're very investable. If you find people who, you know, think they already have the answers, then that's a much harder investment to make for me.
Yeah, I can totally appreciate that. It's interesting though, in talking about your journey as becoming an investor, even though you are, as you say, paying for a job there, you are coming in as an investor and doing things differently these days. And yet, took a bit of a swipe at angel investors, which I'm totally here for. Love a gentle swipe. And you've said they often get into vanity projects, which maybe they should leave that to the professionals. Tell me a bit more about your perspective on that, because I find that really interesting.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I would never use the name angel investor for myself. Like, I don't have any wings. I feel pretty mortal. So I just call myself an investor and try to help as much as I can without giving myself special labels. Mm-hmm. I mean, just to explain the term for people who may not be familiar with it, there's been a little bit of a proliferation of angel clubs and networks around New Zealand over the last maybe 10 or 15 years. And a lot of that has been driven by the Government Venture Investment Fund, which, you know, effectively agreed to co-invest alongside those groups into companies in the very, very beginning. So, you know, subsidized investments, if you like, for those that called themselves angels. And yeah, I mean, I think over the years, I've paid a lot of attention to how that's worked and have observed a few things. So one of the patterns, I guess, that I've seen is that often those groups self-select for the worst investments. And it's interesting to kind of unpick why that is. And I think it comes back to what I said before, that the best founders, in my observation, are very selective about who they choose to have as investors in their companies. You know, they handpick those folks often. And there's a reason for that. It comes down to how much value they can get, and other than just the cash, like we were talking about, but also how easy it is in order to get that investment in the first place. And often these angel clubs are set up in a way that's kind of a little bit hostile to founders. You know, they'll have pitch nights or Dragon's Den or showcases where founders are expected to turn up and kind of, you know, dance on the stage to impress the investors in the audience. Often these groups are a lot of people. So there's, like, you know, a number of people making small investments, which is kind of comes with a lot of overhead and management for the founders. And there's often groupthink as well. Like, a pattern that I've seen repeated over and over again is situations where everybody in the group kind of follows each other into investments, thinking that somebody else has done the work to really validate the opportunity, or that somebody else will do the work to help the company be successful, and they can kind of just ride on the coattails. But often what that means is that nobody's done the work and nobody wants to do the work. So again, from a founder's perspective, it's not a particularly compelling proposition. So yeah, I think, you know, the results of those networks over, you know, a relatively long period of time now kind of reflect those things that I just described that make it harder for those people in those groups to make great investments, I think. So I've just tended to steer well clear and I do love to ask the founders I work with, like, you know, is this working and how do we know? Like, those are two really critical questions to constantly ask when you're working on your own business. And so I think it's kind of interesting to ask those same questions at the next level up of, you know, these ecosystem things like angel clubs and venture funds and say, you know, have they worked and how would we know?
One of the things that you pointed out in your book as a criticism, and I thought this was super interesting, right? Because we talk about diversification all the time. And I think for the average person who is looking to make sense of their money, makes a lot of sense, right? It's just the idea of don't put all your eggs in one basket, invest into lots and lots of things. Something like the S&P 500 share market fund means you invested across 500 companies. If one falls over, no big deal. You've got 499 others. They're all making profits. They're fine. And yet you've pointed out the idea of diversification, which if someone is at your level looking to get in on the ground floor, get in on these companies before they're at all a sure thing, you are not keen on spreading yourself too thin. Explain that idea to me more, because it's a really good point, I think.
Yeah, I mean, and to be clear, like, diversification is well understood and documented theory. Like, I am also an investor in the S&P 500, right? So I understand that theory in the public markets. I think it makes a lot of sense. And I guess the key thing to differentiate it there is, like, if you go to invest in the stock market, like, there's a wide list of companies and you can choose to invest in any of them. That's entirely up to you how you would allocate those investments. But when you look at startups, you don't typically have that choice. Like, you can only invest in the companies that are willing to take your money, first of all, and the ones that are, you know, available to you as an investor. And so, yeah, I think this is the blind spot that a lot of folks who take that diversification approach into startup investments have, is that they don't appreciate that the companies that they see and the companies that they have the opportunity to invest in, often because of the way they behave, that influences the companies that they're able to invest in, you know, that really changes the maths of diversification. And yeah, I think so that's important. I guess the other key differentiator is, like, if you invest in, you know, Apple or Procter & Gamble or Nvidia, those are companies that are well established, and the likelihood that those companies are worth nothing is very, very low. And so when you say, you know, if one of them fails, you've got 499 others, what you really mean is if one of them has a bad quarter or a bad year and the stock price declines slightly, right? That's not the dynamic for startups. Like, when startups go bad, they often die and cease to exist and are worth nothing. And so, like, the lower end of the range of outcomes when you invest in a startup is zero. And so, yeah, like, diversifying and, you know, trying to reduce your risk by investing in more of them doesn't necessarily increase the chances that they won't go to zero. And especially if you've got a selection bias, because you're investing through an angel club or you're investing only in companies in Dunedin or whatever your particular filter for startups might be, the likelihood is no less that you invest in companies that all go to zero. And so, yeah, I guess my mindset there is, I think, and I guess my results have kind of played this out, that it's much smarter to be really selective and have a much smaller basket of companies that you invest in and really put all your energy and your capital into trying to make that small group of companies as good as you can make it. Then you might have some great outcomes. And when, you know, I guess the flip side of that going to zero and being worth nothing is when they go very well, they can be amazing. So, you know, the original investors in Trade Me invested $100,000. That company was sold for $750 million 7 years after their investment. So, you know, the multiple as an investor into that company is extraordinary and very difficult to repeat in any other sense. And so, like, the upside can be spectacular. So, yeah, I mean, why would you diversify and just limit the chances of that upside being as great as it could be? I think if you really back yourself to choose good companies, then yeah, be selective and give yourself every chance to have those amazing outcomes. And if you're unsure, if you do think that there is a selection bias, that you have in terms of the companies that you can invest in, it's probably actually smarter for you to invest in a venture fund and let somebody else do that picking for you.
What would be, do you have a number for the max that you would invest into?
That I can do? Yeah. I mean, the constraint for me is time now. Like, you know, I could invest in more companies, but I would just be spreading myself too thinly across them. So, you know, there have been times in the past where I've had maybe 3 or 4 or 5 active investments at once, and I get pretty stretched at that point. So it's not a big number.
Mm. The point that you're making there in terms of being all in, boots and all, into these business ideas, these startup moments, makes a lot of sense to me. And yet, you know, as you say, you know, also invested in the S&P 500. So you've clearly got a little bit of balance there in your money. And we talk about money a lot elsewhere on this podcast. So if we can just touch on this for a moment, I'd love it, because it's interesting to me how you balance this huge risk in your career, in your business life, with financial stability elsewhere. Still important, right? I mean, you've got a family.
Mm.
What sort of balance did you have? Did you have balance at times like those Trade Me years? Or was it something that you've built up later as you have been sort of expanding your outlook on the business world?
I definitely did not have balance in those earlier years. I was very concentrated in a very small number of companies. And that's a repeated experience. Like, I see that today with the founders that I'm invested in. You know, they are all typically all in on the companies that they're working on and running. Whereas as an investor, I have a little bit of diversification. I have maybe, you know, a handful of companies that I'm invested in, which gives a little bit of a spread. But yeah, I mean, I guess it's also true that I probably have a slightly irrationally large amount of our overall portfolio invested in those early stage companies, but that's where I feel like I have a competitive advantage. I think the important thing for a general investor is they should only be investing money into these highly risky things that they can afford to lose for a start, because that is a possible outcome, and that they can afford to be really patient on, because while the companies are often, you know, retrospectively described as overnight successes, they take years sometimes to achieve those outcomes. So you have to be a very patient investor if you're going to allocate some of your portfolio to that. But yeah, I think it's just a slider, and everybody probably needs to decide for themselves where their tolerance for that uncertainty of returns at all, but also uncertainty in terms of timing of returns. If, you know, each person who wants to invest in these sorts of things, I guess, needs to decide that for themselves, where their tolerance sits.
Yeah. There is a lot of talk, I think, about how tech could be the industry that's good for New Zealand, because New Zealand, we're not great at having the best wages or those really high value industries. We are pretty far away also from the rest of the world. And so tech has been put forward as one of those industries where maybe things like big physical shipping times, not as important, not going to hurt a business as much. And yet, to me at least, I also see that there's a bit of a balance on those perspectives, where sometimes something will look like it's going well. We can put certain companies on a bit of a pedestal. We get really excited. We're like, woohoo, this is our one.
Mm.
And then as soon as you put something on a pedestal, it's just a countdown timer until it falls off, right?
Yeah.
So what do you think is the reality for New Zealand? Are there opportunities for us in the tech sector? And could we be turning more of these good ideas into big, iconic companies?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the first thing to point out is that often those companies that have the most visible crashes have put themselves on that pedestal. Like, it's kind of easy to blame the media for being negative when things fail. But oftentimes, if you really dig into those stories, those people have been kind of talking themselves up and, you know, as I said before, faking it till you make it along the way. And so I sometimes find it hard to feel particularly sorry for folks that have that outcome. Like, the advice that I would give founders is to keep your head down a little bit while there's still uncertainty about what you're working on. It's okay to develop your business in the shadows a little. You don't have to rush into the spotlight straight away and then be one of those people who are kind of exposed to the, you know, the vagaries of failure when they happen. So yeah, I think that's important to understand. A lot of the stories that you hear about and read about are not necessarily representative of what's happening in the wider ecosystem of companies. But yeah, to your question around opportunity, it's a massive opportunity. And we've known this for a long time. Like, if you're right back to 2011, Paul Callaghan, famously sort of identified these sorts of companies as the, as, you know, one of the keys to future prosperity. So that's not a particularly new idea. Like, it pops up again on a reasonably regular cadence. You know, politicians love to point to it, the potential of it. But it's back to what we were talking about before. It's all about the execution, whether we actually achieve those outcomes. And yeah, I think we've proven now that we can. You know, I've myself worked in a number of companies that have grown to become substantial. We've proven that that is possible in New Zealand. There's no longer a question about that. It's just a question of how do we do it more.
If you were talking to a founder now, or if there's someone who's listening, it's like, I have a good idea and I just need to give it a crack. Something to do, something not to do.
Okay, so one thing they should definitely not do is hoard their idea. Like, if you think that you've got a world-beating idea, you may be right, but you're probably wrong. And the way that you'll learn with it, you know, which parts of that you've got right and which parts of that you got wrong, is by talking to anybody that will give you informed feedback and opinions and perspectives on that idea. So yeah, don't be the inventor hiding in a shed until the idea is kind of fully formed and perfect. Get out there and kind of test it. And yeah, I mean, I think it's maybe an unusual piece of advice, but especially if you're somebody who hasn't had experience working in a startup prior, my advice would be go and work in a startup. Like, there are now lots of those companies around in New Zealand. They're all desperate for, you know, qualified people to come and help them grow their businesses. And they're an amazing way to learn what it takes to build a business. So if you just work in one of those companies for a year or two, you'll get, you know, many, many years worth of experience compressed into a short period of time. And then it's very easy to apply that to whatever you choose to work on next. But as we were sort of alluding to before, not just in terms of the idea, but the networks and the capital and all of the other things you'll be exposed to when you work in those companies are all going to help make your, you know, eventual venture much more successful. So yeah, it's maybe a kind of slightly left field piece of advice, but it doesn't hurt to learn on the job.
I think learning on the job is one of the best things. We pull that in on this podcast so many times. It's also what I talk to people about when they're saying about they want to start investing. Start with $5 and learn by doing. Learning by doing, super powerful, right?
Yeah. Practice is so much more interesting than theory.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I want to, slightly left field, we're just going to sort of jag off to the side, because this is an interesting one that, particularly in New Zealand, can be controversial. I find it interesting that it's even controversial to start with, but capital gains tax.
Yeah.
You're actually in favor of one, which is an unusual point of view in New Zealand. For anyone who hasn't kept up with capital gains tax, I mean, New Zealand is a bit weird compared to the rest of the world in that we don't have one. Very quickly, if you have an asset, it goes up in value and you sell that, you'd get taxed on the profit. So selling a house, no tax on that, although we do have the bright line test for if you sell it very quickly, but if it's sold after 2 years, nothing at all. But it also applies to other types of assets too. We often talk about it in terms of houses, but it's also investments. Sell them, no tax there either. Talk me through what you see as being wrong with our current system of no capital gains tax, and what would you change and why?
So, I mean, I think you sort of put your finger on it. I think we have a massive blind spot to this in New Zealand. We are an extraordinary outlier in that we don't have this at all. You know, the other investors in these sorts of companies that I work on internationally, in the US and the UK and Australia even, just expect to pay capital gains tax on capital income on outcomes when they are realized. And don't even really stop and think about that as being an unusual thing. And are often quite surprised to discover that we don't have that in New Zealand. So, you know, we do have a blind spot for it. And I think the reason for that is really clear. As you say, we kind of have this national obsession with investing in property, and that's how we all think that we get ahead. And the idea that you'd be taxed on those gains kind of, I guess, crumbles the business model of residential property investment. So no one really wants to contemplate that. It becomes sort of this untouchable idea politically. But yeah, I think I would use it as a way to kind of connect the dots back. Like, politicians, as we were just talking about, love to talk about how tech companies could be the key to future prosperity for New Zealand, but they never really explain how that's going to actually turn into revenue for the government. And, you know, if we especially if we provide generous kind of incentives and subsidies and grants up front to those companies to help them get started and to grow, which we do and most other countries do too, there has to be some quid pro quo. Like there has to be some way of recouping that investment from the government's perspective. And the reality is that capital gains tax is the way that you would do that. So yeah, like, you know, for investors like me, the idea of a capital gains tax shouldn't be a scary thought. Like investors all around the world cope with this just fine. It gets priced into transactions. So, you know, if we knew that those of us who were investors in TradeMe were going to be taxed on those realized gains when the business was sold, that would have just been another variable that was factored into the price that the business was sold at. So I don't think that part of it needs to be especially scary. The bit that does concern me is when you hear politicians who are in favor of a capital gains tax propose it, one of the very first things that will come out of their mouth is excluding the family home, of course. And so like the first thing we rush to exclude from a system like that is residential property investments. Whereas, you know, you never hear a politician talking about excluding the family business or the family startup investment. So maybe that's a maturity that we would need to kind of come to before that political discussion will be palatable. I'm not sure. But the idea of that shouldn't scare us.
Do you think that we are too interested in buying houses in New Zealand, and should we be doing other things with our money to boost wealth? You know, and obviously a lot of people don't have the sort of wealth that you have built up, but can the average person and should the average person be looking at something different?
I mean, I think it comes back to the constraints. So I'm interested in this space. I don't invest in residential property. Mm. The constraint that every single one of these companies that we have has is people. Like none of them can hire as many great people as they need to work on them and help them grow and deliver those kind of outcomes that ultimately make the country better. So if we really want to grow more of these types of companies, I think we need to think more about the things that actually constrains them. And one of the really practical things that constrains them is that it's very unaffordable for people working on those businesses to live and even own a house in New Zealand. So while we might see property, like the appreciation of property as kind of getting ahead, like just making it more unaffordable for the people that we need to live here and work here and work on the companies here, that's a giant loss, not a victory. So yeah, I think we need to think more broadly about whether, you know, buying little bits of New Zealand off each other at inflated prices is really a path to prosperity.
Yeah. Well, speaking of prosperity, to come back to your journey, you obviously at this point could choose to never work again. You've done very well for yourself in the business world. You've got a bunch of cash. I don't think that's a secret. Why not never work again?
Well, what would I do? I guess I did try that. In 2008, after I finished at Xero, before I invested in Venn, there was a period of time where I tried to do nothing. And I discovered that I'm not very good at doing nothing. It's sort of not how my brain works. Opportunities kept popping up and I wasn't very good at saying no to them. And I think that's a repeated pattern too. Like I think you've seen, I see that in pretty much all of the successful founders that I've worked with over the years and even people who have had success as investors in these companies. Most of us are sort of naturally discontent people who kind of see opportunities and can't help but run at them. And yeah, I personally would not be able to cope very long drinking cocktails on a Pacific Island somewhere, maybe for a few weeks, but I'd get pretty bored pretty quickly. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, as I said before, I was only 30 when we sold TradeMe. I think only All Blacks in New Zealand get to retire at that age. So I'm pleased I kept going.
And I think they've all got bad hips and knees to make up for that early retirement to that point.
There's also that, yeah, there's also that.
One too many scrums and tackles. We've talked a little bit about your advice to people who want to become a founder, but what if someone's looking at your lifestyle, whether it's as someone who's been involved working in these startups or if they're looking at you as an investor who has built up a very successful investing career? If someone wanted to build up the sort of lifestyle that you have now built, what would you say to them?
Oh, good question, Francis. I would say don't start out wanting that lifestyle. I've not seen any examples really where people started out with that kind of hyper-focused outcome in mind and achieved it. I think the people who have achieved that outcome are typically the people who started out with that discontent that I was just describing to actually solving a problem, because that's what sustains you through all those, that hard grind. Mm. You know, if you think that it's going to be a short hop and a skip to a glamorous outcome, to a lucrative outcome, then you're probably going to really struggle on those days when it punches you in the face. Whereas if you start out really wanting to solve the problem that you're working on, or really wanting the thing that you're building to exist in the world, I think that sustains you much better through those hard moments and ultimately gets you, ironically, to the outcome. So yeah, I would say don't start out wanting to be rich or famous. Start out like really discontent about the problem that you're trying to solve, and maybe you'll get there.
Love that. All right. The new book is called How to Be Wrong. Lots of fantastic war stories in there. But also, I just think great insights from the investor perspective as well. Look, if there's one thing that you hope comes from your book, what is that?
I've been writing about these stories for a long time. So I started my blog way back in 2006. I think the internet was still broadcast in black and white back then. So for a long time, there's been a small audience of, you know, founders and maybe other investors who have kind of followed that writing. And I've tried to share all the patterns and things that I've learned. Mm. And really, this book is about trying to take those and package it in a way that can be read and understood and hopefully enjoyed by a much wider audience. Like if I can get more people to be curious about the opportunity to work on and invest in these companies, ultimately that's what creates the outcomes that we're talking about. So yeah, that's what I hope to see with this book. I hope to see a lot more people kind of engaging in these things that we're talking about today.
Yeah, fantastic. All right, where can people find the book? I'm sure they all want to rush and pick up a copy right now.
You can buy it online. If you go to howtobewrongbook.com, you can buy it directly from there. And it'll also be available in a few selected bookstores around New Zealand as well. So look out for it there.
All the best bookstores, I'm sure. All right, thank you so much. That's Rowan Simpson, author of the new book, How to Be Wrong, sharing some of his fantastic war stories with us. Now, of course, if you have more questions about this or any other topic, do get in touch with me as well. I know some of you have been interested in the wilder side of investing, so I tried to squeeze as many of your questions in there as I could. If you have more, let me know. Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Francis Cook NZ. Send me those questions. I'll try to get them into a future podcast episode for you. You can also, if you don't want to be dictated to by these awful social media algorithms, also sign up to my newsletter. Sort it all out. I'll get right in touch with you every week with free money tips. It's the Money Memo. It is linked in the show notes. You can also find it on my website, franciscook.co.nz. Don't forget to subscribe to Making Sense everywhere you find podcasts, including Apple, Spotify, YouTube. Until next time, have a great day.
Just a note before you go, this podcast can only give you general information about how things work in most cases. It's not individual financial advice. We're all different, so some of this might not apply to your specific situation. Take what works for you, ignore the rest. If you're after individual financial advice, a financial advisor is always the best bet.